Let us look now at our next study, which is 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9 and 10. Today I want to move very quickly through this section. We have a lot of work to cover, so I won't be able to spend a lot of time developing a lot of the points here. What I really want to do is to make sure that we see the whole of these three chapters in their right setting. One of the great problems we always have is that we know some parts of the Bible just a little too well for our own good. That is, we are familiar with certain verses in certain places, and quite often we miss out on the meaning of those verses in their original setting. Now, these three chapters all deal with the one issue. You might say that the issue is food offered to idols, which doesn't sound terribly relevant to us here in Western society, in so-called Christian society. That's why I've given it the title Personal Rights, because really that is what these three chapters are about. Let me just give you some background to the story here. In Corinth, and in many countries of the world today, that is, non-Christian countries, in heathen countries where there are idol temples, it is the custom for people to have meals in temples or in places associated with idolatrous worship. And quite often the food that the people eat in the meal is first of all offered to the idol. We have this in Thailand in certain ceremonies, each year in birthday ceremonies, in dedication ceremonies for buildings and schools and offices, government departments and things like this, where food may be presented to the priests and afterwards it's eaten together in a meal which the people enjoy together. Sometimes the food is offered to the idols and then is eaten later on. Sometimes it's presented to a spirit as part of the annual celebration. Religion is worked into the normal celebrations of everyday life. Now, this was a problem in Corinth because many of the people had been quite accustomed to eating at the local temple. Now, I don't mean with any idolatrous associations. They were idolatrous worshippers originally, and so they used to go along to the temple. But even now that they were Christians, some of them probably still went along, not to go inside the temple, but around these temples there would be places selling food, small food stalls, like we get at a school fete, that type of thing. You see those things quite a lot around the temples in the East. But sometimes the food has been first of all offered to the idols. When a person joins in the feast, this raised a problem for some. More emancipated Christians said, look, it doesn't really matter whether the food's been offered to the idols or not. The food is still the food, it hasn't been changed. Beef is beef, cabbage is cabbage, tomatoes are tomatoes, and they haven't been changed intrinsically through having been offered to idols. But other Christians who'd recently been won from idol worship didn't see it that way. To them, the idol had real power, and there was real religious significance in the fact that this food had been offered to idols. And they said they didn't want to have any part in it. It was as if they were having part in idols. And so there was a conflict then between the stronger Christians and the more sensitive Christians. Well, Paul deals with this, and he starts off by saying, we all know that an idol is nothing. It's only a piece of wood or a piece of stone. Now, we all know that. But people who have recently been converted from idol worship may not see it exactly that way. To them, the idol has exerted a great power over them in years gone by. And it still has a certain power, and so they don't want to eat. Now, the more emancipated Christians, they were coming along and saying, look, it doesn't matter, let's just join in and eat it. The food hasn't been changed, it's the same as it's always been. The idol is nothing, it's only a piece of wood or a piece of stone. Why bother about it? And Paul says, in effect, well, I suppose there's some truth in that. Though as he moves on, he's going to show us that these pieces of wood and pieces of stone are not simply pieces of wood and pieces of stone. It is true, he says, that the food isn't changed, but that is no reason for the freewheeling Christian to go along and partake in these feasts to his heart's content. He has to be aware of the effect which his example could have on somebody else. And if he went and ate in these feasts, he himself may not be affected. It may not bother him, but another person may be affected. Having recently been won from idol worship, this person may go along and follow his example and slip back very easily into former idolatrous practices. We all know that an idol is only a piece of wood or a piece of stone. We all know that there is only one true God, says Paul. But, and this is important, the Christian does not base his decisions solely on what he knows. Knowledge is not the sole basis of our decision. there is a more important consideration, and that is love. I make my decision not simply on what I know and what I want to do, but on the basis of love. How is my decision going to affect somebody else? That's the basic consideration. We have our rights, says Paul, but we must be prepared to forego our rights for the benefit of others. Now that is the message of these three chapters, and although Paul is going to talk about a lot of things, I want us to see the whole of those three chapters in this context. Now I'm going to breeze through fairly quickly. If you can hang on with me as I read these verses from the RSV as usual, I think you'll get the drift of the argument. And try to concentrate on what Paul's drift of argument is. Now concerning food offered to idols. Now that was the next question that had been raised in their letter. Okay, says Paul, I've dealt with the one concerning marriage. Now I'm going to deal with your question concerning food offered to idols. Okay. All of us possess knowledge. We have this knowledge that idols are nothing. But, Paul says, knowledge is imperfect. Knowledge has the tendency to puff up, to make us inflated with our own importance, and to do what we think is right without consideration of others. Knowledge has the tendency to lead to pride, but love builds up. That's the important thing, says Paul, it's love. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he doesn't know anything yet, as well as he should know. But if one loves God, one is known by him. And so the Christian is guided by love. Now he goes on in verse 4. We know there's only one God, he says. As to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence. We know that there is no God but one. We know all these things. But down to verse 7. It is true, he says, that not all possess this knowledge. Recent converts, just freed from idolatry, may not have this same clear-sighted perception of the uselessness and lifelessness of idols. Those idols have had a great spiritual force in their lives in days gone by, and so they don't see it quite as clearly, maybe, as a person who has been more cut adrift from idolatry. The important thing, he says, is not food, but consideration of others. Verse 8, food will not commend us to God. We're no worse off if we do not eat. We're no better off if we do eat. It's not food that's important. What is important is verse 9. Take care lest your liberty somehow becomes a stumbling block to the weak. That's what you've got to be careful of. Because if anyone sees you, a man of knowledge, a mature person, eating at table in an idol's temple, might he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak man is destroyed. The brother for whom Christ died, his spiritual life can be destroyed through your bad example. The important thing, says Paul, is not what my rights are. My important consideration is how will my action affect somebody else. I am motivated not by selfishness, but by love. And it's better to eat nothing, he says, if it's going to harm another person. Better to refuse one's freedom than to have one's own personal rights as a means of a stumbling block to others. He gives his own example. He says, I, for example, have rights. I am an apostle. And all the way through chapter 9, you're going to notice this mention of his rights. I have an apostle, I am free, he says. I am an apostle, I have seen Jesus, and you are my workmanship. You, Corinthians, are proof of the authenticity of my mission as an apostle to the Gentiles. If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, because you are the seal of my apostleship. Other people might say, Paul's only second rate, he's not an apostle, he wasn't one of the original 12, they can say what they like. But Paul says, you people surely can't say it, because you're the very proof of the effectiveness of my apostolic ministry. The Corinthian church came into being because I exercised my apostolic ministry. And this is my defense in verse 3 to those who would examine me, to those who would criticize me, he says. Some were criticizing him. Some people were saying, Paul is not really an apostle because he doesn't live like the other apostles. I mean, Peter and Barnabas and James and some of those chaps, they were full-time Christian workers. They were supported by the churches. They didn't have to work as laborers to support themselves because they got all their income from the Christians. But Paul, on many occasions, preferred not to take money from the Christians. He didn't want money to be a stumbling block to them. And we all know that money can be. People will always criticize evangelists and Christian workers. That is, non-Christian people will very readily criticize church people if they think they're out to get some money for themselves. And Paul was aware of that. So to cut the criticism at its source, he said, I won't even take any money from the church. While I'm living in Corinth, he said, I'll work for 4 or 5 hours a day at my trade as a tent maker, canvas goods, sail making, things like that. He said, I'll work at my trade and I'll get enough money to support myself. Now, of course, there were some Corinthian people who said, there you are, Paul is only second rate. He's not really a proper pastor, because if he was a proper pastor, he'd be here at the church doing religious things all the time. He's only really a self-taught man. He's just a labourer. He's got his ordinary work, and then he does his church work in the spare time. Quite clearly, he's not a proper apostle. Now, that was the criticism Paul had to put up with. And so Paul defends himself, and he says, I had the right to full-time, total financial support from the church. I had that right, the same as every other apostle. But, he said, I waived my right. I sacrificed my right in order to help you, the church in Corinth. And I got little thanks for my efforts. That's what he goes on to talk about. Verse 4, do we not have the right to our food and drink? We, meaning the apostles, to be supported by the church, get our income from the church. Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife, as the other apostles and the brothers of our Lord and Cephas are? Don't I have the right, he said, not only to walk around by myself and be supported, but if I had a wife, then she too could be supported, just like Peter's wife is supported, and James and Barnabas and all these others. He says the church supports them and their wives and families. He said, I have this right too. But, he said, I haven't claimed that right. Incidentally, I may have given you a wrong lead there. It appears there that Barnabas must have suffered a little bit with Paul. Apparently, because Barnabas was with Paul on occasions, he also had worked as Paul had, and perhaps he had got some of this backlash that Paul had got, because it mentions that in verse 6, that apparently Barnabas had suffered through a lack of support. So really what I should have referred to in verse 5 then was not Barnabas, but rather Peter, James, and the other apostles. That's just by the way. He then gives a number of illustrations to show that in any walk of life, the worker gets his living from his occupation. Verse 7, a soldier gets his living from his occupation. A vineyard worker gets his living from his occupation. A shepherd, end of verse 7, he gets his living from his occupation. Verse 9, a quote from the Old Testament, even an ox gets its living from its occupation. You don't muzzle the ox so that when it's walking around treading out the corn, going round and round in circles and trampling out the corn with its hooves, it is not muzzled. In other words, it's allowed to eat and nibble as it goes. It gets its food out of the work it's doing. He goes on to speak, for example, in verse 13. I'll come back to these verses I've missed out in a moment, but just notice his illustrations here. Verse 13, the people in the Old Testament temple service, again, they were supported. The Levites were supported by the people. The temple singers, the temple officials, were supported financially by the people to whom they ministered. And it's a consistent principle of the Bible that the people who minister in the church are supported by the people to whom they minister. Verse 14 sums it up. In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. It's as simple as that, says Paul. We have our rights and we are entitled to it. But, he says, I have not pursued those rights. Going back to verse 11, just to pick up a couple of those verses I skipped over, verse 11, he said, for example, if I have sown spiritual good among you, surely it's not too much to expect to reap some material benefit. Too often, I believe, in our churches, we don't support those who minister to us. There's an old saying, you get what you pay for. And if the standard of our ministry at times is rather poor, it's not to be wondered at when we haven't really gone to the trouble to pay people so that they, like Paul and Barnabas and these others, can spend their full time in doing properly and efficiently and fully the work that God has committed to them. But so many people are not able to spend their full time and their full gift in the work because they have to spend it earning money to keep themselves alive. Here's a reminder again that the church has a responsibility to support those who minister to them. And if we diminish that responsibility, well, naturally, the service the people give us is correspondingly diminished. And so in the long run, we are going to suffer. He says, if we have sown to you spiritual good, surely the least we can expect is material compensation. Pay for the work that we have done. If others, in verse 12, share this rightful claim upon you, do not we still more? I mean, these travelling preachers, you pay them and they come through, they get their $20 and move on again. But what about us who live among you and work consistently in your midst? Don't we deserve this likewise? But, verse 12, second half, we have not made use of this right. We have the right to be supported by you, but we have not made use of it. We endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel. He doesn't want anybody to misunderstand him. He doesn't want people to think that he's out solely to get money, and there will be people who'll make that misinterpretation. Even in the church, you'll find there will be people who'll misinterpret and think that a person is doing service for God simply to get paid for it. The person does service for God because he does service for God, but he is entitled to be rewarded for it, entitled to be maintained by the church. But you have these small-minded people at Corinth who would distort those facts, and as I mentioned, I believe there are still some small-minded people around among us today. Paul repeats in verse 15, I have this right, but I have not made use of my right, because I knew that you were such carnal, immature, misunderstanding Christians that I didn't want to give you the opportunity to criticize me. My reward, he says, is in verse 18. My real reward is that in my preaching I may make the gospel free of charge, not making full use of my right. Now, there are many people in the church who feel the same as Paul. They preach and they serve God in various capacities in the church, and they are entitled to a financial reward. Many of them prefer not to take it. They may say, look, I have income from another source. Thank you very much, but I don't really need that support. Their reward is simply in serving Christ, and they have some other means of support. So while they have that other means of support, they feel they shouldn't be a drain on the church's finances. And to those people, we have to say full commendation for such a noble and very Christian attitude, but not full marks to the church when it takes such people for granted. Now, the person doesn't do it to get the thank you. He does it in verse 18 as Paul does it. That's his reward, simply to serve Christ. But it's nice to know that the people who are receiving at least have some appreciation of the fact that this is God's work, and it is to be treated with dignity and responsibility, and not treated as something that's slapdash and spare time, and we can look upon it nobly if we like, or we can dismiss it as being unimportant if we want to. Let us have a high view of the service of God and pull up our socks a bit and take care of our responsibilities in these areas. Paul says in verse 19, he says, I am free from all men, and yet I make myself the slave of all. Note again the context he's talking of here, the context of idol worship, where people say we are free. Paul says, so you are free. But that doesn't mean to say that you can go into these idol temples. We're to make ourselves servants of each other. Maybe the person has been saved. Maybe the person has been liberated from idolatry. Maybe he is free from all that bondage. But he has to be in bondage, in service now to his brother. He's not free to trample all over everybody else, to live as he wants to do without reference to anybody else. He has to consider the other person. We are to be servants of one another. And so though I am free, I have made myself a servant to all. To the Jews, he said, I became like a Jew. Verse 21, to those outside the law, I became like those outside the law. To those under the law, I became like those under the law. I sacrificed my rights. I limited my freedom. I went along with people as far as I could feel it useful in the cause of Christ. He said, I didn't simply stand on my rights and do the things I wanted to do. He said, I made those sacrifices in the cause of the gospel. To the weak, for example, in verse 22, I became weak. There's a reference perhaps to these new converts, because many new converts are weak. They're very sensitive. They don't quite know where they're going. They've just been plucked from the heathenism of Corinth. Paul says to these Christians in Corinth, to the weak I became weak. Why don't you follow? Why don't you be sensitive to their weaknesses, their tendencies to failure, the hangovers from the former life which still haven't eradicated themselves yet? Why aren't you sensitive to those things? Paul says in verse 22, I was sensitive to those things, and I trust that you will be too. There's a great need in the Christian life for self-discipline. That comes through very strongly in all the letters of the New Testament, and Paul rounds off chapter 9 with that thought, this thought of self-discipline. For example, verse 25, an athlete exercises self-discipline. Now we, he says, are like athletes. We're running a race, and at the end of the race there's going to be a prize. And it's not just a prize of a few laurel leaves wrapped around somebody's head, as in the ancient Athenian games. No, he says, it's a lasting reward. So if an athlete disciplines himself simply to win a gold medal at the games, how much more should I discipline myself to earn something, to be rewarded with something which is far more lasting than silver or gold or leaves or cups or certificates or anything else that the winner happens to get. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, we an imperishable. So he says, I don't run aimlessly. I don't box like one beating the air. I don't poke holes in the air, shadow boxing. He says, I land my punches with perfect aim. I run with complete commitment to get to that finishing line. And in verse 27, I pummel my body. I discipline my body. I subdue my body. I control my body, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Dreadfully possible. Dreadfully possible that a person can be a preacher and a servant of God, and because he lacks self-discipline, can finish up a wreck. After having preached to others, he himself can finish up being disqualified. Doesn't mean to say he's losing his eternal salvation. We're not talking about that. Paul's not talking about that. He's talking about the person who can make a wreck of his life if he is not keeping control of himself. And so there's a good warning, the warning to self-discipline. And there's another warning that comes up in chapter 10, the first dozen or so verses, a warning from Israel who lacked self-discipline. He tells us here that it's possible, it's dreadfully possible, to join in the full fellowship of God's people and yet to miss out on the final blessing. A warning to the people in Corinth. Don't think that you are not going to be affected by the evil, immoral, idolatrous tendencies of society. Don't think that everybody else is going to be affected by them, but you won't be. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. That's what Paul says in chapter 10 here. And you and I should take heed. The fact that we are part of the visible community of God's people is no reason why we can just cruise along and think that everybody else is going to fall into sin, but we aren't. Here again, the Christian needs self-discipline. Take the people of Israel, he says. All of your fathers were under the cloud. They all passed through the sea. They all came out of Egypt. They went through the Red Sea. They were led by the cloud. All of them, he says. And they were all baptized under Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Nothing to do with baptism in Christian baptism, but it means they went through the water. That's all it means. They went through the water with Moses through the Red Sea. And so they went on. They got food. They got drink, the same as Moses. They went through the bush, the same as Moses. But, he says, with most of them in verse 5, God was not pleased. Because they disobeyed, they rebelled against God, and they died in the wilderness. They came out of Egypt. They enjoyed the blessings with Moses. They were part of the visible community of God's people, but they never entered into Canaan. Because, he says, they lacked discipline. They fell by the wayside. God was not pleased with them. Verse 6, those things, he says, are a warning for us. Do not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters. Now you see the relevance again to the idolatry thing here. They were idolaters. As it says, the people sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to dance. We must not indulge in immorality as some of them did. You see the connection between idolatry and immorality. And anybody who's lived in an idolatrous society has seen that connection. Idolatry brings a tremendous sense of relief to a person. You go to the temple, you do something, you bow down, you make an offering, and the sense of achievement is great. The tendency then is to go away and feel I've done my deed for the day, my deed for the week. I've achieved something, I can measure it, I can see it. I've made this sacrifice, this offering to the idol, and then the restraint is off. You and I have experienced the same thing, I'm sure. Sometimes when there's been a fairly significant Christian experience, perhaps it even is the Lord's Supper, perhaps it's something to do with some church service, so often, immediately after that, we have a great feeling of euphoria almost, a feeling of attainment, of achievement, and that's when Satan attacks. That is one of the problems with idolatry. It makes people lax. Done their religious duties, Satan then tempts them, and too often they fall into immorality. So there you have it in verses 6 and 7, the connection between idolatry and immorality, and Paul is saying this, if you fiddle around with idolatry, watch out, the next thing you know you'll be hooked on immorality as well. Verse 12, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. Don't think you're the only one that ever's had temptation. But remember this, God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your strength. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape so that you're able to endure it. The temptation is there. The people have a way of escape, and now Paul is going to talk about the way of escape. And the way of escape is going to be this: have nothing to do with idolatry. The temptation is there in the temple. The idols are there. The food is there. You could eat the food if you like, but it is the thin end of the wedge. And it's easy, he says, to slip from simply eating food offered to idols into the actual worship of the idols, to become associated with the idols. And he's going to move on now to show that eating food offered to idols is a form of fellowship with the idol. And that's very common. We all know that eating food together is a great way of fellowship. We do it at Christmas, we have our friends and relatives around for special occasions, we have birthdays for our children, we have eating together as a time of fun and fellowship. This is great communal intercourse, great social intercourse. The Lord's Supper again, fellowship. We eat together, we drink together. Now it may only be a token meal that we eat and drink together, but we do partake of bread and wine together. And the essence of it is communion. Communion means sharing or fellowship or interaction the one with the other. Now Paul says, if you eat the food that is offered to the idol, in a sense you're having fellowship with that idol. As in the Lord's Supper. We eat food together and we are having fellowship with Christ. So that the Lord's Supper is more than simply a memorial. It's more than simply remembering Christ. It is communion with Christ, communion with one another and with Him. So verse 14 he says, shun idols. And then he goes on in the next verse to say, I'm speaking to sensible men. Verse 16, the parallel now with the Lord's Supper. The cup of blessing which we bless, that is the cup that we take in the Holy Communion, in the Lord's Supper together, is it not a participation or a communion in the blood of Christ? It's not just a piece of drink. He said it is an actual act where all of us together drink in an act of corporate fellowship with each other and with Christ. It is a participation in the blood of Christ. The bread which we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? It is a united sharing spiritually together with one another in Christ. We have partaken of Him by faith, and we demonstrate our faith, we demonstrate our union with Him and our union with one another when we partake of bread and wine together, fellowshipping with each other in Christ. We have partaken of Him by faith, we have appropriated to ourselves the benefits of Calvary in His sacrifice, in His body given as a sacrifice, in His blood outpoured, His life given. We have partaken already of the benefits of that through faith when we first came to Christ. And we reenact that every time we partake of the Lord's Supper together. It is a joint participation, it is a fellowship, it is a sharing, it is a communion. Verse 17 he says, there is one bread, and so we are one body in Christ. So that's his first example, showing that to eat and drink together means having fellowship with the thing that we are partaking of. Now the second example in verse 18, consider the practice of Israel. And that is the case of the altar, where in ancient times the priest would offer the sacrifice on the altar. Now the people would bring him the sacrifice and the priest would offer the sacrifice. Sometimes the people were entitled to eat part of the sacrifice, and most times the priests were entitled to eat part of the sacrifice. Again, fellowship together. So consider the practice of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar? Isn't the eating together, he says, part and parcel of all that the sacrifice means? So there are my two examples. The Lord's Supper in New Testament times and the offering of sacrifices in Israel in Old Testament times. Well, now, verse 19, what do I imply? This, he says, that food offered to idols is something that is important. Do I say that food offered to idols is anything or that an idol is anything? No, he says, I'm not trying to say that the food is intrinsically changed or that the idol has any life within itself. But what I am saying is this, that what the pagans sacrifice in verse 20, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be partners with demons. So he says, that piece of wood, that idol, made of wood or stone, has no life. It has no personality, it has no power, it has no existence, in the sense that God has existence. You might say it's nothing. But he says, I can't really dismiss it as being nothing. and nor do the converts dismiss it as being nothing. He says, behind idol worship is the power of Satan, the power of evil spirits, and those who join in idol worship, he says, are in the grip of Satan, and by their idolatrous worship they are actually participating in the activity of evil spiritual powers. Now, he says, do you see that it is not simply a case of eating food? There is a lot more to it than that. If you eat food together in the Lord's Supper, how, he says, can you then go and eat food together at an idol feast? If eating food together in the Lord's Supper implies fellowship, then eating food together in an idol feast likewise implies fellowship. And the two don't mix. Verse 21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? I hope not, says Paul. And then he concludes by going back to something he said earlier. All things are lawful, but all things are not helpful. Now that's what people were saying, all things are lawful. Apparently that was a fairly common saying in Corinth. They liked that one. All things are lawful, I can do as I like. And Paul says, well, you can say that if you like, but that's not the whole point. Knowledge is not the consideration. Whether I know a thing is lawful or not is not my basic consideration. Whether I have the right to do a thing or not, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing, he says, is it helpful? Does it come from love? Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. All things are lawful, but all things are not helpful. They're not building up. Now what you've got to do, he says, is realize that your behavior is affecting other people. And what we want is to have behavior that builds other people up, at the end of verse 23. He goes on in verse 24 then. No one seeks his own good, but the good of his neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. That is the basic Christian responsibility. Just a couple of questions arise here. He doesn't want people to get themselves tied up in knots over this. And so he points out that if they know the food has been offered to idols, all right, they are not to eat of it. If a person comes to you and says, oh, we just brought this food in from the idols, we just offered it, we had a big ceremony out there, now we're going to eat it together in a meal, Paul says, if you know that, then refrain from eating it. Now, I've been to ceremonies in Thailand where this has happened. Weddings, funerals, annual dedication ceremonies of government offices and businesses and schools and so on. And the food is presented to the priests and to the idols, and then it's passed around and people eat of it. So one has to attend some of these functions, but you don't eat. Just like we go to funerals of people of different persuasion from our souls. We may find we can go to the funeral because we want to express love or sympathy, but we don't feel that we should join in certain rituals. Now likewise with the food offered to the idols, it may be grandma's birthday, or it may be the annual school ceremony, and the idols are there, and the priests are there, and the food is offered. But you say, I'm not going to eat of that food because I know it's been offered to idols, and I want to demonstrate that I'm not having anything to do with idols. So Paul says, if you know it has something to do with idols, don't eat of it, because you're going to be a bad example to somebody else, and somebody else's conscience may be harmed. In fact, your own might be harmed as well. However, if you just buy some food and you don't know if it's been offered to idols or not, then he says, just eat it. For example, you might eat food in somebody's house and you wouldn't have a clue where it came from, because a lot of the food that was sold in markets was food that had come from the temple. It had been presented to the temple, collected by the temple authorities, and then taken down the market and sold to the traders, and the traders would just sell it through the markets. The people who go into the markets don't know whether it's been brought from the temple or not. They don't know whether it's been offered to idols or not. Now, the food hasn't been intrinsically changed. So, Paul says, if you buy food in the market, or if you're eating at somebody's house, and there's food set before you on the table, just go ahead and eat it. Don't ask questions about it. If you get food in the market, don't ask questions about it. It's just ordinary food. It hasn't been changed. It's exactly the same. Whether it's been offered to idols or whether it hasn't, the content of the food is no different. But if somebody draws your attention to the fact and say, this is idol food, then you know that that has significance in that person's mind. Therefore, you take a stand against it. Now, I'm sure there's a basic principle here that you and I could follow through in many aspects of our lives. Those cases where we know well, then we have no excuse. But if it's the case where we don't know, then Paul says there's no point in creating these unnecessary difficulties. After all, there's nothing immoral about the food itself. It hasn't changed its molecules or its vitamins or something of that nature. So just go ahead and accept it and give thanks to it as food given to you by God, because all food ultimately comes from God. However, he says, if it is food offered to idols, you know it's been offered to idols, you sit down at the table, you say grace, you give thanks for the food, and then somebody eats it knowing it's been offered to idols, and that person is led into sin, then he says it makes a bit of a mockery of your giving thanks for your food, doesn't it? You give thanks to the food, thank you God for giving me this food which is going to help this other brother to be led into idolatry. Paul says that's a bit stupid. So you see, he says you don't do it. We'll just read those few verses and then we're through. Verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the marketplace without raising any question on the ground of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. In other words, the food is good, God made the food, eat it and be thankful. However, he says, verse 27, if one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you're disposed to go, there's nothing wrong with that, he says, go and have a meal with an unbeliever, that's perfectly acceptable. Eat whatever is set before you without raising any questions on the ground of conscience. But if he says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then out of consideration for the man who informed you and for conscience sake, then he says, don't eat of it, and so on. And then verse 30, the reference to giving thanks for your food, I think in the King James Version it uses the word grace here, which is where our English expression to say grace has come from. Rather not expression when you think of it. It comes from the King James Version. It means to give thanks for your food. Verse 30, if I partake with thankfulness, that is, if I say grace, give thanks for my food, why then am I denounced because of that for which I gave thanks? Pretty stupid, he says, to give thanks for my food, to eat that food which has been offered to idols, and as a result bring condemnation upon myself because I have led another young Christian into idolatry through my stupid action. So what's the conclusion? The conclusions in verse 31 to 33 are twofold consideration. Firstly, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink anything at all, do it all to the glory of God. And that's our first consideration, everything for the glory of God. And secondly, verse 33, don't please yourselves. Don't stand on your own rights, just as I try to please all men in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but seeking rather the advantage of others, that they may be saved. One of the great difficulties of modern society is that Christians are tempted all the time to develop the selfish attitudes of people round about. Well, here Paul is telling us it is still a valid statement that Christians must be prepared to forego their rights. Personal rights, we can pursue them to the death. We can ride them hard to get our own way. We can be like other people and talk all the time about I have the right to this and I have the right to that, but it is a thoroughly unchristian attitude, and if we act that way, we are not bringing glory to God. We are not living the way Christians should live, and we are not helping others either. Paul says, one, do everything for the glory of God, and two, disadvantage myself for the sake of bringing advantage and benefit to someone else.